I'm Jason Michael Perry, the man with three first names, and this is Thoughts on Tech and Things. Summer Game Fest wrapped at the beginning of June. This is where the top gaming companies preview their upcoming summer releases, and this year was no exception, with a ton of very high-profile games announced. A bit before all the announcements dropped, I was in Philly for Philly Tech Week, and I had a chance to sit down with Dr. Frank Lee at Drexel. Frank is a professor of digital media and the founding director of the entrepreneurial game studio at Drexel. We sat down to talk about a question that turns out to be a lot harder than it sounds. What is a game? So let's get into that with Frank, but first, a message from our sponsors.
Got a baby on the way? It's time for Hoopty. I'm Roxy Aldrew, Baltimore-based inventor of Hoopty Hoops, NFC-enabled silicone rings that turn any baby bottle into a smart device. Just tap to sync your bottles with our free app. Hoopty tracks your bottles, calculates expiration, and sends reminders so you never waste a drop. Shop gethoopty.com. That's G-E-T-H-O-O-P-D-E-E.com and use the code THOUGHTS20 for 20% off.
Invested in AI but not seeing results? You're not alone. Perry Labs helps organizations figure out what's working and what's next. Start with our AI assessment at perrylabs.io.
My guest today is Frank Lee, professor of digital media at Drexel and the founding director of the Entrepreneurial Game Studio. Frank has a PhD in cognitive psychology from Carnegie Mellon and an undergrad in cognitive science from Berkeley, which already tells you that he doesn't think about games the way that most people do. He co-founded Drexel's game design program in 2008, now ranked one of the top 10 in the country. I'm here in Philly, recording out of WHYY with Frank, and I am hoping to see the biggest Tetris game or the biggest game in the world, something that's going to happen here as part of Philly Tech Week this Friday. And I'll ask Frank a little bit more about that. Frank, welcome to Thoughts on Tech and Things.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So I grew up in what I think was the magical age of video games. My brothers and I feel like, had almost every gaming system that you could imagine. Commodore 64, all of the Nintendos, you know, the PlayStation when it came out. On my personal computer, played Doom and Wolfenstein. You know, kind of crazy to think of a 4 megs of RAM or this machine and this game, how amazing it was. But Doom changed a lot. It was one of the first-person shooter games. And When I think about this, and you know, and my kids now with Xboxes and just a different generation, I have to wonder, somebody who specializes in gaming, what was your entree to this? What was your first system? How did you get started?
Sure. So the first game system that I owned was Atari 2600, if you recall. And just listening to your history, it sounds like we followed a very similar path as well. I had Commodore 64, which I mainly use for gaming. But Atari 2600 is the first console, first commercial consumer-level console, and that's the system that I had. And Pong was one of the first, if not the first game that I played. And during when I was growing up around late 80s, mid-late 80s, you know, that's when the what I consider golden age of the arcade, right? Mm-hmm. You go to the arcade, you have Pac-Man, Asteroid, all of these machines and so on. So played a lot of those arcade machines, played games on Commodore 64. For some reason, for the most part, I played games on computers. So I played games on my Mac SC30 during Berkeley.
Oh, yes. So
I haven't really came, I didn't come back to consoles after the 2600 until much later with the Xbox and PlayStation and so on. So I miss a lot of the SNES, the Nintendo system era.
We did a pre-call to talk about this this podcast conversation, and you said something that has sat with me for a little bit now, that gaming is one of the youngest art forms that's out there. And just as we talked about Pong came out in 1972. This is a pretty young thing, video games. The first video game came out in 1958, which was something called Tennis for Two. I wasn't born then. That was, you know, before me. But Pong was the one that I think really moved things forward commercially and really started to show us what's possible in this video gaming space in a way that other games just nothing did before that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tennis for Two was basically a research project. So I would peg Pong as the first widely commercial game, and basically the beginning of the game industry, right? And like you mentioned, it was in the 70s. And that's only 50 years ago. And game within university settings, studying game studies, I would sort of peg around 2000 as where the sort of growth started at that point. So, and that's about 25 years ago, 26 years ago. So it's fairly young.
For someone who's wondering what game studies looks like, you know, can you tell us a little bit about your role at Drexel and the program and the things that you do?
Sure. Just to step a little bit back, I was first a professor of computer science from 2003 to 2013 before I decided to move over to digital media. And I co-founded the Game Design Program as a computer science professor with a colleague in digital media. And gaming within computer science involves, as you might imagine, programming, right? Development and so on. From the digital media side, involves production, art, and so on. And if you actually look at people who are in gaming now in academia, they're coming from a lot of different places, from psychology, from media, from film, from computer science, and so on. And whatever program that they create would have their flavor of from where they're from. So it isn't any one thing, but we are all sort of joined together by, one, our passion and love for games and the potential of games to, I think, engage people, to have an effect broadly across society.
It's interesting to, as a computer scientist, as a programmer, imagine that everyone thinks of game development as a software engineering thing. But these are, again, the youngest art form. These are very creative pieces of work. There's a lot of storytelling. The plot, the narrative, there's voiceovers, there's music, there's artwork. I mean, in a lot of ways, these are cinematic productions, almost like producing a movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at some of what people consider AAA or the kind of high-end games like Halo and others that you might have heard of, like Call of Duty, probably at peak, you're looking at somewhere between like 500 developers, right, or 500 people working on that game at once. So it is not just programming, though people might think of it that way because it is software, but ultimately it's a software for engagement and entertainment, right? Underneath it is you have to think about the person, you know, mm-hmm. What would engage that person? What would engage that person to buy this game and play for hours on end, right? So it's not a software like Microsoft Word, which is important, but you have to use, right? So it is, game is something that's different because it's something that you choose to buy for fun and entertainment, to use your precious money, to spend your precious time to gain engagement and entertainment.
Speaking of time, I wish I had more time to play video games these days, but one of the last games that I played, The Last of Us, The Last of Us 2, which has been remade into a TV show that's also very, very good and very amazing. And watching the movie and playing the game, this isn't what you think of as like Mega Man or one of these older games. This is a movie. I mean, it really feels, again, like a cinematic experience. And the more that I find myself in this experience, I found myself asking this question, what exactly is a game today? Like, how do you define gaming? And is it a bigger thing than we realize in a different type of interaction that we're creating here?
That is a wonderful question. And games could be very close to movie-like cinematic experience, as you mentioned. Last of Us, Drake's Fortune, and sort of those type of games will certainly have that flavor, sort of deeply written, engaging stories. The only thing that I would point out is the difference, the key difference between, let's say, a movie and a game like Last of Us is that within the game, it puts you at the center of as the character, right? You're making choices within the game. Within movies, and that's a first-person experience. Within movies, it's a third-person experience. You're watching, you're observing other people do stuff and so on. So given that difference, you have, you know, this fully cinematic world that you're going in and exhibiting and making choices and making decisions. But at the other end of it are very simple games like Tetris, right? That's not a cinematic experience, but I would say is equally or possibly even more engaging for people who play Tetris, which I still play Tetris and so on. So I feel like it's sort of, games cover a broad spectrum, But I guess tying that all together, is this an aspect of how do we engage people in this activity, in this playful activity, and so on?
As a kid, I loved the choose your own adventure books. It's a similar thing. You can pick the way or your morals in some of these games and decide what the world looks like. Now, you mentioned that third-person view with the movie, but the world today, which I think is very different than the way that I grew up, but my son, we bought Spider-Man, and the Spider-Man games are very, very good. And before we had a chance to play the game, he'd watch the entire playthrough on YouTube and experience the entire thing. And again, going to the cinematic experience of some of these things, and I understand that there are differences between games, that there's increasingly a large audience of people using tools like Twitch or watching on YouTube and experiencing long-form cinematic games. These are games that can be, you know, hundreds of hours, and experience it almost like a TV show as opposed to putting themselves in a position to play them. I just wonder, where does this line, you know, live between these experiences? Just another thing to add to that, Netflix, Reed Hastings has said that they're not competing with other streaming groups. They're not competing with HBO and these other streaming organizations. They're actually competing with attention, with the attention span. That's video games, that's reading books, that's anything that takes your attention. That's what they're competing with. And it feels like video games kind of fit in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you consider like a movie, you would have you would capture the attention for about 2 hours, give and take, right? But with a game like Last of Us and others and so on, if you kind of just play through the main storyline, it might be 20, 40 hours. But if you look at all the branches, like you mentioned, branching stories of books, you know, these are branching narratives within these games where a decision that you made might affect decisions later on and so on. If you go through all the different areas, kind of optional areas that's not necessary to the main story, you may be getting up there 80, 100 hours, right, of game and gameplay and so on. And if they involve games that are replayable, that's, you know, double or triple that amount of time and so on. So it is a huge attention grabber, but the game has to be designed well enough to keep you, paying attention versus after an hour, it's like, this game is horrible, so then stop playing.
Speaking of games that consume hours, when my daughter was born, it just happened to coincide with the release of World of Warcraft, which is a online game, so the content just keeps coming, it keeps growing, and I can't tell you how many hours I spent with the character that I created just playing in this massively online, you know, game. That it's a community. It's a place where you can talk to people, you can hang out with your friends, but it's also a game. And it's a game where your decisions and the things that you create are really up to your imagination. And with AI, we're seeing this happen more and more.
Yeah, absolutely. I think AI is its sort of infant stage for applications even beyond games. And certainly within games, there is an attempt to explore how AI could be used in game development, especially in art and in programming would be sort of the obvious places. But certainly there is, you see it in the news, pushback, right, from consumers that they don't want AI-generated art in these games. And the developers have basically responded to the consumers, going back to the notion that this is something that people choose to buy, right? So you have to answer to the people. And there is certainly a reluctance as well as sort of...
Hesitancy?
Yeah, I have to say. Not even the hesitancy, because I want to say something that's harder, but there is a strong dislike, I think, at this point. It may change over time, but there is a strong dislike of AI-generated art, among other things, and by consumers for computer games and so on.
The distinction or the realization that this is not a world of a bunch of computer programmers just sitting in the room, that they're storytellers and artists, is an important piece. The same, I think, pushback that we're hearing in AI from creatives, movie creators, animators, these are the same folks who are also incredibly important in the gaming industry. You may not realize it, but there are some amazing actors that are voiceover actors that provide their voices for characters in these games. There's a lot of 3D artwork. Some of the same people who are using things like Unreal Engine, which is the gaming engine, to build games are also doing this in movies, right?
Yeah. So one of the important things, as you pointed out, is that game engine, specifically gaming software, has gone beyond making games. It is currently being used within the film industry for a lot of real-time special effects. Mandalorian is the first widely known example of using that. And what it involves is building a huge LCD wall, which you're replicating the actual world, right? Whether it's Tatooine in Star Wars, you're creating the environment in software and have actors acting in front of those LCD screens, versus before you would have the actors in green screen and then during post-processing put in all the environment that way. But here you're capturing the actual environment that's generated in software. So you're able to create sort of this real-time special effects. And one of the kind of interesting things that I read, which I hadn't considered, is if you have like shiny metal suits like you might have in Star Wars, and you have a green screen, then that green screen is reflected in all the mirror surfaces of the suit. So you have to go and hand wipe out all that stuff. But if you actually are reflecting the real environment in LCD, that real environment is being reflected right on the metallic surfaces. So there's kind of interesting sort of benefits beyond time saving and other aspect of it. But that in movies, but you could also see game engines being used in TVs and not just TVs, but in like news and other programs, right? Showing effects of flood, like in real time and so on.
The Weather Channel has used Unreal Engine or some form of gaming engine to demonstrate the level of water or what a storm may look like. And I think many of us think of this as CGI, but really that's computer graphics, right? It's the same thing. It's just this morphing of the same tools that we're using for television and movie production with the same tools that we're also using for gaming, which again comes back to that, what is a game? Like the space is, there's a lot of crossover in the types of talent, the types of things, the types of tools that are needed for game creation across this entire space. Something that we had a chance to talk about also is the dynamics of things that are games that aren't really games. I have a client called Resilience Innovation Labs, and they do this thing called system dynamics. I'm not going to bore everybody with it, but basically they model future trends for cities and governments. It's kind of like a crystal ball to say, this is what happens if you reduce workforce development spending or if you increase it, things like that. Now, you did something very similar to that, the SimCity of Philadelphia, which is a game, but educational in a way. Can you tell me a little bit about this?
Sure. The Sim Philadelphia was a project that was funded by the Knight Foundation. And the goal was, how can we engage the people, especially in Philadelphia, to let them know about the open data that's available from the city and interact and engage with it and understand it? So the pitch that I made to Knight Foundation, and they accepted, was to create a SimCity-like game. And so if people are not familiar with the SimCity game, it is a simulation of a city and so on. And what we did was, in Sim Philadelphia, we actually use real city data from open data from the city government, including property value, tax, and other aspect of it, to try to create an interactive sort of game-like environment to showcase why, for example, gentrification happens, why health deterioration happens when there's a food desert, among other things. So those things you could do in a simulation mode that you can't otherwise do, and so on. So the difference between SimCity and Sim Philadelphia was, using real data, we wanted to engage people in Philadelphia to get to know more about the data that's available and to using that data in an interactive and fun way.
that's one of the powers of video games, is the educational possibilities, the way that you can simulate or create things in interesting ways. On the AI side of the world, there's increasingly this concept of digital twins. And a digital twin is when a manufacturing organization might stand up using something like Unreal Engine, a simulation of their manufacturing process, so that they can run through multitudes of simulations to figure out what things might happen or how things could happen to possibly predict the future. NVIDIA, which is one of the biggest games in the gaming industry, they built the GPUs that are powering data centers, but also historically have powered gaming machines and big gaming rigs, uses this technology with AI to help create autonomous cars, self-driving vehicles, by creating models of cities and then using those models of cities to simulate driving in all types of environments, to then take that information back and then use that to become the training data that's used for these models. And again, this is games. These are the same folks who are modeling, you know, The Mandalorian or the movies that are now taking this and using this to create AI models to train the brain that then powers a self-driving car. So there's this interesting space here of how this stuff all overlaps. And in my time, I always am fond of some of the educational games that I grew up with. Mavis Beacon to learn how to type. We use this thing called Math Blaster, which sometimes is fun if you actually like math. Carmen Sandiego, I think, has taught me almost everything I know about geography and history. So there's this other side. And I know that you work with a lot of middle school teachers, high schoolers, as well as college kids, obviously. What are the types of things that you are showing or helping to teach or give them exposure for the possibilities in the gaming space?
I guess one thing that I've been deeply passionate about is to get middle school kids or kids in general interested in STEM fields, particularly computing, using game design as a way to get them interested in. So I've run workshop with Girl Scouts, with middle schoolers from schools around in and around Philadelphia. And the way we do it is to have them come in to do a workshop, a game design workshop, and have them make games that are then presented either on the skyscraper or in other places, so that they will become interested in programming and programming concepts. And there is this notion of computational thinking, which actually views the process of how you program, meaning that you take a big problem and break it down into a little problem, is a strong and positive way to approach problems. So in addition to just trying to get them interested in computing just through games, we are hoping to increase computational thinking among these kids.
That's awesome. You mentioned the skyscraper. You're in the Guinness Book of World Records for the biggest game that existed. Is that how I would explain it?
The official title is the largest architectural video game display. But I might as well, I think it's easier to call it the biggest game in the world. So to give a little backstory, in 2013, I did Pong. And again, going back to my roots of Pong being the first game that I played, I showcased Pong as a public installation on a skyscraper in Philadelphia called the Sears Center, which is a beautiful glass, 49-story tall glass building in Philadelphia. And what's unique about that building is that it's right in middle of the train station, so there's no other tall buildings around, so it's visible everywhere. And the other thing that's unique about that building is that they have these LED lights that are used for simple light shows, but with permission and support from Brandywine Realty Trust, and at that time, Atari as well, I was able to reprogram those lights to play an interactive game of Pong across the Schuylkill River from the Art Museum on
that's
the north
awesome.
Side. And following year, in 2019, as part of the 30th anniversary of Tetris, in collaboration with the Tetris company, we had multiplayer Tetris running in 2014. And using the same building with funding from Intel Corporation and Brandywine, we were able to work with middle school teachers and middle school kids to have them design new games. They were then showcased in 2019, and we're doing it again as part of the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence this year to showcase the creativity middle school kids by showcasing their games on the Sierra Center.
And that's Friday, as part of Philly Tech Week, the last day of the Technically Builders Conference. And I have a pass to play the game on the skyscraper. I can't wait. I did want to close. So if someone is listening and they want to understand what they can do with games, how to be involved in the game industry, as a person who's teaching students interested in AAA games or, you know, middle schoolers who are interested in STEM and STEAM, what are the things that you tell them to look at? What are the skills you tell them to hone? Where do you tell them to start?
I would say first, think about the games that you do play, whether it's video games and board games. And in games, I don't distinguish between video and board games. And even the games that we used to play as kids, like tag and so on, those are all games to me. So whenever you're playing a game with your friends, by yourself, or with your family, almost metacognitively step back and think about, why am I enjoying this, right? What is it about this game, about the rules and the interaction of the rules that is making the game interesting to me? So that would be a first step of being a game study person. If you are interested then going into the game industry, certainly this is a challenging time for tech industry in general, but I would always recommend looking at Drexel and other programs that are highly ranked and viewed to consider that as an option towards a first step toward gaming and so on. But certainly that's not the only option. You could just be making games at home. The tools that were very expensive before, like the Unreal Engine, people may not know the Unreal Engine used to cost around $300,000, right, just to get a license to make games on that engine. But those tools are now all free and available for people to download and make games and so on. So it's a great time to be a game creative because of the tools are available. But at the same time, a lot of people are making games as well. But certainly think about games more than playing. Think about educational path in gaming, whether it's Drexel or somewhere else, and follow your passion.
Thank you, Frank. Frank Lee is the professor of digital media at Drexel and the founding director of the Entrepreneurial Game Studio. Thanks for joining us on Thoughts on Tech and Things.
Thank you.
Before we go, a humanoid robot in China was doing a martial arts demo, roundhouse kicks, spinning. A kid wandered in too close and the robot kicked him square in the stomach and the kid bent over in pain. Apparently, it's the second time that this model of bot has hit a child during a demo like this, just this year. So what could possibly go wrong? All right, folks, that's Thoughts on Tech and Things for the week. Let me know your thoughts by leaving me a message in the WYPR app, calling 410-735-1616, or find me at jasonmperry.com. Thanks to the team at WHYY in Philadelphia, our on-site audio engineer, Diana Martinez, WYPR's Shania Mapson, and Myrna Martinez, head of operations and marketing at Perry Labs. New episodes drop every other week. I'm Jason Michael Perry. This is Thoughts on Tech and Things, and I'll see you next time.